In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just a few minutes, we'll learn about the reset at the Environmental Protection Agency under Biden and the new EPA Administrator Michael Regan, a preview of the changes at the EPA from an Iowa environmental health scientist who's just been nominated to serve as an EPA advisor. But first, let's get a handle on some of what's been happening at the Iowa State House this week. We're joined by Katarina Sestarek, IPR's state government reporter. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about a few things here. Has it been already a month since that tragedy, March 23rd, two employees at the Anamosa State Penitentiary killed while on duty, sparking a debate about funding for the Iowa Department of Corrections within the larger context of the overall budget debate? Tell us what's been happening there.
Right. It seems like, you know, almost no faction agrees on what the funding for prisons should be. The House and Senate Republicans have different ideas right now. The House Republicans proposed a $20 million increase. Senate Republicans proposed a just over $6 million increase for prisons. Democrats are saying there needs to be even more than that, and some other changes made too, like restoring collective bargaining rights. And then you have the head of the union that represents correctional workers, Danny Homan, saying, you know, there needs to be a lot more funding. And it's just a big ongoing debate. And it is, you know, a really tragic situation, the killing of these two workers at Anamosa. And Danny Homan said that he talked with the families of the two people who were killed, and that they told him to fix this so that no other families have to go through this. And he said, you know, the way to fix it is more funding and staffing. But Senator Julian Garrett this week, who is the Republican in charge of the justice budget in the Senate, which again is proposing a $6 million increase, said that he doesn't want to jump to conclusions that it was necessarily a lack of funding and staffing that led to the killings, and said he wants to see the results of the investigations that are ongoing before providing more money for that.
Mm-hmm. Also budget related, some news on funding or lack thereof for the three Regents universities, Iowa's public universities, the University of Iowa, the University of Northern Iowa, and Iowa State University. What's been going on there with their budget?
House Republicans raised some eyebrows by saying they want to give no funding increase to the Regents universities. And they also want to prohibit the universities from raising tuition and fees, essentially just freezing, you know, the amount of money that they have. And Senate Republicans would like to give an $8 million increase, but that would really just replace an $8 million cut that was made last year. So restoring them to a level of a couple of years ago. And so this is going to be an ongoing debate. Both proposals are a lot less than what the Regents asked for, and the universities are dealing with a lot of budget shortfall issues from the pandemic.
What is the reasoning Republicans are offering for no increase for the funding for the three public universities and also prohibiting any increase in tuition and fees?
Some of the House Republicans have said, you know, essentially that they think the cost of providing this education has become too bloated. They're concerned that, you know, Iowa families that are paying tuition are just paying for more administrative positions, but they didn't really provide evidence that that's the case. And they also even mentioned, you know, some concerns that they have about free speech issues, that they say, you know, people with politically conservative views aren't being treated fairly on college campuses.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a couple of bills advancing in the legislature related to policing. Tell us about those.
There's one really long bill that the House Republicans passed this week. It would increase protections for police and also increase penalties for protest-related offenses and do a lot of other things. It's a very long bill. But basically, the House Republicans were saying, you know, this is our show of support for law enforcement officers. We want to show that we have their back. And, you know, there were, of course, also some mentions of the racial justice protests and that, you know, raising penalties for some of these protest-related offenses is a response to that. Some House Republicans didn't see those protests as peaceful. They were mostly nonviolent protests.
Mm-hmm. And how are Democrats, who are in the minority in both chambers, responding to these policing bills?
8 Democrats voted with most of the Republicans to support the bill. The remainder of the Democrats voted against it. And some of them, you know, raised concerns about things like raising the penalties for protest-related offenses is something that could increase racial disparities in the criminal justice system and could also have a chilling effect on lawful protests. And then things like adding the qualified immunity standard into state law. Some Democrats are concerned that could protect police who commit misconduct.
Mm, okay. Katerina, in the minute or so that we have remaining, give us your sense of what we have to expect in the next few weeks of the session. The session is coming to an end, right?
It should be. Technically, the last day of the session should be April 30th, but they can cut it shorter than that or they can go longer than that. It's really just going to depend on House and Senate Republicans and the governor's office agreeing on final budget negotiations, maybe a few more policy things. And then there's also an ongoing discussion of tax cuts that, you know, those are going to be the things that determine when the session will end.
Mm-hmm. And so it's as typically is the case. It's the budget and that ends the session, and it's really an open question how long debate over that and what will be hammered out in the final version, right?
Right. Yeah.
And Katerina, perhaps a brief comment because we know that we just had a census, and then the legislature is required to go through the redistricting process that happens once every 10 years. The census data is late, so what does that look like with the legislative session ending soon?
We still don't know. The Iowa Supreme Court put out a pretty vague statement recently. It's still not clear what role legislators will have in, you know, will they get to be the ones who approve the legislative redistricting maps or not? It's not, still not really clear. So we're still waiting to find out what that's going to look like.
Okay, thanks for the update. Katerina Sestarek, IPR state government reporter. Take care, Katerina.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A couple of weeks ago, Michael Regan, he's the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, fired dozens of independent scientific advisors, many of whom were installed under the Trump administration. Now, this was an effort to rebuild what Regan described as a balanced group of experts to inform clean air and water policy. Now, scientists and experts sit on these independent boards for the EPA, and they play a critical role advising the agency, everything from air and water quality standards to pesticide use. Now, the vacancies created by those firings are now in the process of being filled. One of the nominees is environmental health scientist Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa. Thorne is very familiar with the role of advisor to EPA. From 2015 to 2017, Thorne chaired the Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board. He's professor and head of the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, also director of the UI Human Toxicology Program, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences and current chair of its Committee on Toxicology. Peter Thorne joins us once again. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Ben. Love your show.
Thank you. And our listeners will remember, perhaps, you were with us on this program just after Biden's inauguration back in January, describing the likely changes in the EPA under our new president. Congratulations on your nomination to serve once again with the EPA. We'll we'll see how that goes. You have a process to get through before you actually sit on that advisory board, I understand. But let me quote the new EPA administrator, Michael Regan, and have you tell us a little bit what's behind these words. He said a couple of weeks ago, scientific integrity is one of the EPA's foundational values. And as administrator, I'm committed to ensuring that every decision we make meets rigorous scientific standards. Resetting these two scientific advisory committees will ensure the agency receives the best possible scientific insight to support our work to protect human health and in the environment. Today, we return to a time-tested, fair, and transparent process for soliciting membership to these critically important advisory bodies. The words of EPA Administrator Michael Regan. Peter, explain what's behind these words.
Sure. Happy to do so, Ben. I got to go back to 2017 when new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, under the new Trump administration, changed the time-honored and I would say venerated process for appointing experts to serve on EPA advisory boards, and in particular the Science Advisory Board, which we affectionately call SAB, and the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee, which we call CASAC. And so changes to these included really three things that were important: the disqualification of scientists whose universities received EPA funding to support their research. The second was changes in the process of evaluating the qualifications of scientists who were nominated to serve. And then the third was the relaxation of consideration of conflicts of interest. And that was especially true for nominees from the regulated industries. So what ended up happening is this disqualified many, if not most, of the academically affiliated advisors, the ones who really had the greatest expertise. And then this allowed Administrator Pruitt to fill those positions with people representing the regulated industry. And I have to say that these advisory boards operate under code from two major laws. One is called FACA, the Federal Advisory Committees Act, and the other is called ERDA, which is a long acronym for Environmental Research Development and Demonstration Authorization Act. But FACA and ERDA specify how these boards operate, and clearly these changes were not consistent with those two acts.
I wonder, a lot of nuance there, a lot of minutia there. Can you tell us?
Sorry.
No, that's fine. but perhaps more in shorthand, can you tell us a little bit more about that departure? Because the EPA has existed since the 1970s. And so you're saying that what you described there, what happened under the Trump administration, under Pruitt, was a departure from both from the EPA under Republican and Democrat administrations.
Yeah, absolutely. The EPA was first organized under a Republican administration, and it was very, very popular on both sides of the aisle. And it continues to have a broad support from the American public. And many of the great things that the EPA does, people aren't even aware of, but the actions of EPA have saved many, many lives. It made our air, water, soil, and food even safer as a result of their actions. So the role that these advisory boards, the SAB and CASAC and several others, perform is that they ensure that the EPA uses the very best science in all their decision-making. You can't have an organization like the EPA using flawed science to try to enact law enact regulations and rules and enforce laws that Congress passes. Mm-hmm. So they're exceedingly important, and they periodically are charged with reviewing. A number of regulations and rules come up periodically for re-review to make sure that there hasn't been new science to say, oh, we were regulating a little bit too much or not enough. We're always trying to make sure that we protect human health and the environment.
Nevertheless, there's been Republican pushback. Some Republicans have called this a political purge. How do you react to that description?
Well, I'm not overly surprised by that, but I think there were reasons that that Administrator Regan really had to take this action. First of all, in April of this of last year, the U.S. Court District Court for the Southern District of New York ruled that EPA could not block recipients of agency funding from participating on its boards. And then that ruling also went to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and they also decided in favor of that. Then there was a July 2019 General Accounting Office review of the process that Administrator Pruitt had used, and they found that it had violated FACA, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, because it bypassed the EPA staff members' critical evaluation of credentials of nominated scientists to serve on these. So given that there were several legal violations, I would say, of that, I'm not an attorney, but this is what I understand, and that the GAO ruled that they hadn't followed the procedures, I think that really this made it imperative that Administrator Regan do take this action. Mm-hmm. So those who are criticizing him for it, I think, should make themselves aware of the fact that this was heard in the courts and by the GAO, and that this is the directive that was given.
If you just joined us, Peter Thorne, environmental health scientist at the University of Iowa, nominated once again to serve on an advisory board to the EPA. In the few minutes that we have left here, Peter, give us a sense of how the EPA plans to move forward with its agenda and with your advice and others' advice.
Yes, well, you indicated that at the outset that some of the current board members that were appointed through this flawed process were fired. But you know, we serve as special government employees, but it's really considered more almost voluntary. And so we do serve in the service of the agency and the administrator. And so going forward, we know that the Biden administration has put a higher priority than past administration on renewable energy solutions, climate change and global warming issues, environmental justice issues. So these will be at the forefront of new policies coming through EPA, and the administrator will want to make sure that those are well grounded in the best science. So we will be tackling those without a doubt. And then there's likely to be a reboot on looking at the control of emissions of various ambient air pollutants, including particulate matter, especially fine particulate matter, and ground level ozone, because those are particularly hazardous airborne pollutants, and we'll probably have the opportunity to re-review those to make sure that the standards that are in place are either safe or maybe lower the standards, meaning make them more restrictive, if the science calls for that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can say from your vantage point, Peter Thorne, what the Trump legacy is regarding the EPA. Scott Pruitt, his successor, was it Wheeler, the successor to Scott Pruitt? What is the impact, would you say, of those 4 years? Is it something that now under Biden and Regan that this will, all these directives can just be undone? Or is there sort of a lasting impact of the Trump administration and the EPA then?
Yes, I think time will tell. Andrew Wheeler continued some of the policies of Scott Pruitt, although he, you know, was not so much in the news as his predecessor. There was a huge brain drain from the EPA in the last 4 years. Many people who had been there and were the brain trust of the operation elected to retire or take other jobs because they just saw that the mission of EPA was being undermined in their view. And so rebuilding the organization at many levels is going to take quite some time. In addition, there were some actions that were taken that can't easily be reversed unless they were done in a manner that violated the law or the operational regulations of the organization. And there were several cases where actions taken in the past 4 years did not conform to the law. And so therefore those can be revisited pretty quickly. So it's a combination of things. Some will happen quickly and some will take time.
Okay, Peter Thorne, thank you very much. We're going to take a break right now. I want to ask you on the way out, Peter, because after the break, I'm going to be talking with IPR's Kate Payne about this, about a new report issued by American Rivers that puts two Iowa rivers on the most top 10 most endangered list of the nation's rivers. And I know you know a lot about water quality. Comment, if you could, briefly on the way out about why water quality in Iowa and the Midwest is such a challenge.
Yeah, well, we have one of the major problems we face, and it's not just Iowa, it's the Midwestern agricultural states, the Corn Belt in particular, is that there's a lot of land under cultivation, and we use a lot of fertilizer to grow the crops that we do and get the high yields that we get. But we haven't always done a great job of controlling the runoff of these nutrients into waterways. And when these nutrients then go down to the Gulf of Mexico, and we're talking mostly nitrogen and phosphorus, and suspended solids of soil, when these go to the Gulf of Mexico, they form what we call the dead zone there, which is a real problem for shellfish and fishing, and really hurts that environment. And so it's imperative that we do more to control this and cover crops and no-till and a whole variety of agricultural interventions have been shown to be effective, but we just need to get wider adoption of those in order to start to make any inroads on reducing the runoff of nutrients into these waterways.
Okay, thank you very much. Peter Thorne of the University of Iowa, environmental health scientist. He's just been nominated to serve once again on one of the EPA's science advisory boards, the science advisory board for the EPA. Peter Thorne, thank you for the conversation, and I'm sure we'll speak again in the future.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Coming up, we stay on the topic of the environment. This week, as I just mentioned, two Iowa rivers were named among the nation's top 10 most endangered by a national advocacy group. When we come back, I'll talk with IPR's Kate Payne. She'll explain some more about which rivers they are and how agricultural pollution receives much of the blame. Also, Cassidy Arena tells us about Iowa's first Latino Film Festival. That's when we return. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. Back in just a moment.
Legislature is in session.
Let's just go around. We got a lot of people.
There are proposals for constitutional amendments, education, taxes, the budget, and many policy bills.
So what needs to be fixed?
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, is following the session.
I want to thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
I'm John Pemble. Subscribe to the podcast or hear Under the Golden Dome on our website, iowapublicradio.org.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few moments, IPR's Grant Gerlach with some news this week related to Iowa's public schools. Also, Cassidy Arena tells us about Iowa's very first Latino Film Festival. And of course, we'll groove into the weekend. Mark Simmet will be joining us. But first, two Iowa rivers are among the nation's top 10 most endangered. That's according to an annual report. It was released this week from an advocacy group, a national advocacy group. Kate Payne is with us, our Eastern Iowa reporter, and she's been covering this this week. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Tell us more about this list, who puts it out, and the appearance, unfortunately, of two Iowa rivers.
Yes. So this is an annual report that's put out by a group called American Rivers, and they focus on rivers that they say are at a crossroads and for which actions taken in the coming months could really determine their fate. So really some urgency behind these rivers. And for Iowa, the Lower Missouri River was rated number 2, and the Raccoon River rates number 9 this year.
Okay, let's talk about those individually. The Lower Missouri, what section is meant by the Lower Missouri, and why has this become a problem? It has been a problem for years, I understand.
Yeah, so this is the section of the Lower Missouri that runs from Sioux City down to St. Louis, so right here in our backyard. And the main concern from American Rivers is the issue of poor flood management, which they say poses a really direct risk to public health and to public safety. And so just sort of some background for folks, the Missouri River was once this massive, meandering, really dynamic river with tons of back channels and sandbars and islands, really complex, until the federal government really set their eyes on commercial shipping through the river. And so in the past century, the river has really been transformed by engineers, by humans, and an extensive system of levees and flood structures was put in place to artificially constrict the river, to limit its footprint and raise the depth to make it deep enough to navigate.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we can imagine without all these back channels altering substantially the Missouri River, just decimated wildlife. And we've had flood risks that have increased because of it as well.
Yes. And scientists have long told us that these kind of levee structures, this kind of engineering makes flooding worse, that levees make flooding worse. And that's by raising the height of the rivers and speeding up the flow rates. And so when those levees collapse, as they have done on the Missouri, they have failed, we see even worse flooding outcomes. And what advocates want to see is more room for the river. And that's an approach, a philosophy that we really see more commonly in Europe. And it's this acknowledgement that, you know, we have to give back more of that historic floodplain, and that allows for better flood control and just more sort of surface area for the river to ebb and flow. But the reality, in order to do that, is that, you know, there are people who live and work in the floodplain right now. There are homes and farms, small communities there. And so if this kind of action was taken, those people would likely have to be relocated. And that's, of course, incredibly difficult personally, emotionally, and politically. But the flip side, of course, is as we continue to see devastating flooding, as we have in recent years on the Missouri, that's equally and incredibly difficult for those individuals, for those communities, and for taxpayers who are in this cycle of refunding the rebuilding of failed levees.
Kate Payne, tell us a little bit more about the other Iowa River on this nation top 10 most endangered rivers list. This is the Raccoon, a tributary of the Des Moines River in central Iowa, part of the Mississippi River basin, and it's a key drinking water source for, hundreds of thousands of central Iowans, isn't it?
Absolutely. So again, the Raccoon River was rated number 9 on this list. And as you mentioned, it's one of the key drinking water sources for the Des Moines Water Works and serves some 500,000 central Iowans. And the main concern here from American Rivers is agricultural pollution, runoff in the river, and the threat that that poses to drinking water in particular. And the group points to Iowa's confined animal feeding operations, which, of course, are a major facet of the state's economy and which produce a tremendous amount of waste, of manure. And a lot of that can be used as fertilizer in the right proportions. It can be incredibly valuable and useful. But researchers have shown us that what we're seeing is broad over-application of manure at rates that the soil can't take up those otherwise valuable nutrients, and they run off in the water. And so we're seeing high nitrate rates, ammonia, these issues, toxic algae blooms as well, issues that are incredibly challenging for utilities to try and maintain our drinking water below federal safety standards.
Kate, before we go, I know you've been covering Iowa's water quality for some time here, and this is a sort of a latest chapter, a latest news event in it. What will you be watching in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think we'll be looking for more pressure again on small communities that are over and over having to deal with these high nutrient rates. Certainly a lot of attention is giving to places like Des Moines because the Des Moines Water Works serves so many Iowans. But cities like Des Moines also have an incredible amount of resources, of ratepayers, and in some ways are better positioned, better resourced to deal with these high nutrient rates, where other communities downstream on the Raccoon River, on other rivers in the state, have less resources to invest in, you know, these world-class nitrate removal facilities. They just can't do that. And certainly smaller communities as well of 1,000 people trying to figure out how to supply clean drinking water to their communities. It's a constant struggle.
Kate Payne giving us some details on the latest annual report released by an advocacy group, American Rivers, putting two Iowa rivers among the nation's top 10 most endangered. Kate Payne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this April 16th. Hope you're doing well. Let's have a quick check with IPR's Grant Gerlach, who focuses on education as part of his reporting and has been doing that this week. Grant Gerlach, welcome to the program.
Good to be back with you, Ben.
Let's talk about your reporting there with Iowa City schools struggling quite a bit with COVID outbreaks.
Yeah, they got into a situation where the number of students in quarantine was rising quickly and reached a high number. And it's something they felt they had to address, and they did so this week. Before the school board met on Tuesday, the district's website said that more than 1,000 students and staff were in quarantine due to exposure to someone with the coronavirus, and that included 983 students. Keep in mind, not all students are in class. That's with roughly 60% of the student body learning in person to begin with. So there were a lot of students out of school in quarantine at that time. And it had gotten to a point where it was becoming an issue of frustration for a lot of parents. The district had been holding on to a 14-day quarantine policy. And that meant some kids had gone through multiple rounds of quarantine. They had missed a lot of school. They were missing sports and other activities, which is always a point of frustration for families and students. And anecdotally, there were some board members that mentioned that maybe some kids were getting together and hanging out while they were supposed to be in quarantine, which defeats the purpose of isolating from others to keep from spreading the virus. So they decided to look at this quarantine policy again and make a change.
Mm-hmm. What changes did they make?
Well, they went from a 14-day quarantine to a policy that allows students to end their quarantine earlier. And basically, they adopted some guidelines from the Iowa Department of Public Health. And that says that after 10 days, if a student hasn't had any symptoms, they can end their quarantine, or they can end it after 7 days if they've had a negative test. And the thing that really impacts it is a guideline that if the person who is infected is wearing a mask properly and the person who's considered a close contact is also wearing a mask properly, then there's no need for the close contact to quarantine. The person who's infected still has to isolate, but the people who are considered close contact don't need to quarantine. They just monitor themselves for symptoms. And there's been an immediate impact on the number of students and staff in quarantine. As I mentioned, on Tuesday, it was more than 1,000. As of yesterday, the most recent update, it was down to 225. So it's a policy that has a big impact on the number of students that are in class and required to stay home.
In the minute or two that we have left, Grant, also COVID-related, tell us about more money being directed for mental health services in Iowa schools.
Yeah, there's a batch of money that went to states that Governor Kim Reynolds is deciding to use a portion of it for a grant program for schools to provide some more mental health support for their students. She says that, you know, mental health is a big concern as as schools welcome more students back in person, but there's still the impact of the pandemic. So she wants schools to have more resources to provide mental health first aid and other sort of support programs for students, like suicide prevention, that kind of thing, to make sure that students who are struggling with mental health have some resources that are available. And this comes on top of federal money that's also going through the state to schools to address other COVID costs like hygiene and airflow and also learning loss, which is another huge issue that schools will be trying to address over the summer and on down the line.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like money that is needed and good to put to use that way. Thank you so much, Grant Gerlach, IPR reporter.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, news this week, we heard that Des Moines will host Iowa's first ever Latino Film Festival this summer. Cassidy Arena joins me now to tell us about that. A reporter focusing much of her coverage, her work on the Iowa Latino community, Spanish-speaking community here in Iowa. Hi, Cassidy.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on the show. Now, this is something that was originally planned for last year, one of the many events that had the kibosh put on it because of the pandemic, right?
Yeah, it was originally planned for the spring of 2020, but of course, COVID-19 kind of postponed many plans, including this plan to host the first Latino Film Festival. So now it'll be this June. Mark your calendars, June 18th through the 20th.
Mm-hmm. It's free. I see that. How do people take part or attend? Because this will have a physical dimension as well as a virtual one, right?
Yeah, so people can either, it is free, you are correct, and people can either watch it online, virtually, or at the Riverview Park Amphitheater in Des Moines. So that's where the films will be broadcasted, along with a lot of other fun activities like street dances, food vendors, and kind of they're leaving it a little bit of a mystery for all of the little activities that'll be there. And all of the films will be in Spanish, in their original Spanish, with English subtitles. So if you're not proficient or fluent in Spanish, no worries, you can still enjoy the films.
That would be me, for instance. talk about how this is funded, because there is a larger, longer-term goal embedded in this festival, isn't there?
Yeah, so the festival is run by the Latino Center of Iowa. And as of right now, they don't actually have a physical location or a physical building. And that's part of why they wanted to host this, to kind of gain funds and gain donations in order to build that. So they've partnered up with a few different organizations, including the Chicago Latino Film Festival, which is, you know, relatively successful. So it's through them that Des Moines will actually be able to feature four international Latino films. And then, you know, other organizations such as the Greater Des Moines Partnership is also giving some grants and donations in order to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Away from the festival, you've been covering some vaccine outreach, more efforts to reach Iowa's Latino communities with these COVID-19 vaccines. You reported, though, the outreach is there, but they're not always successful.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely much better than it was right at the beginning when vaccines were first introduced as an option to kind of fight back against COVID-19. So there are many more groups trying to organize either bilingual vaccination clinics or even just information sessions. And yes, there have been more, but the questions asked at those information sessions and clinics kind of remain the same. So it's just a matter of really reaching people where they are and making sure that they actually understand what you're asking. So, you know, I've spoken to people who, you know, have given feedback about, yes, there's this information session, but the information session flyer is in English. And so a Spanish speaker, you know, wouldn't know how to access the information session if the flyer is in English.
Okay. Well, some improvements needed while it's repairing the bicycle, while you're riding the bicycle or improving it. Anyway, Cassidy Arena, IPR reporter, thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too.
All that we need to do is to groove into the weekend, an important part of our News Buzz Fridays. Mark Simmet is with us, one of the IPR Studio One Tracks hosts. We have a couple of tunes that you've suggested queued up. Tell us about the first one.
Well, the first one's from an Australian band. We love Australian bands here at Studio One. This one is Middle Kids, and they have a new album out, their second release. Middle Kids is a trio. Two of the members are married to each other. Hannah Joy is the lead singer and songwriter in the band. And they recently actually got married, and domesticity you would think would be a theme in the album, and I guess it is in a way, but it doesn't mean settled necessarily. Here's one called Are You For Me?
Nice choice, Mark Simmet. Are You For Me? The band Middle Kids. We have time for one more tune, Mark. Send us into the weekend with what?
Well, we're going to slow it down a bit with the next one, a band called The Antlers, and they are Americans this time from Brooklyn, New York. Also a trio, at least most of the time, sometimes augmented by other players. One of those bands that started out as a solo project, a singer and songwriter by the name of Peter Silberman, in Brooklyn, started the Antlers, and this is a track called Wheels Roll Home from their latest album.
I think you said the name of that tune, The Antlers, an American band. Nice and mellow. Thank you for grooving us into the weekend, Mark. Remind us quickly, how can people tune in to IPR Studio One Tracks?
Well, you can hear Studio One Tracks 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. We also have started a Saturday afternoon show now at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with a few special features added.
Okay, Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One. Thanks so much, Mark. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Ben, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Before we go, I want to mention Monday on this program, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley is due to be my guest. Because of the senator's schedule, he'll be unable to join us live, but I'd love to have questions from you, our listeners. What would you like to ask Senator Grassley? Email your question to me this weekend or right now. The email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is the email. Send your question for Senator Grassley, due to be on Monday. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.